Into the show, we wanted to flag that we have our first ever live show coming up on the 8th of May. It'll be about museum gift shops, as in our tagline, getting drunk in the gift shop with the Angel of History. But it's also a bit of a party because we are quickly approaching, and actually also by the time that this airs, we will have made, will have got 100,000 downloads.
Ooh. 100,000.
So, yeah, so thanks so much for listening. It will be at my university, which is Birkbeck, with a 7:30 sharp start and a small reception to follow. And it's free. So if you like your podcast live and your wine warm.
Yeah, yeah. Particularly white wine warm. Yeah. In a polystyrene cup. Maybe a warm Beck's, if you're lucky.
This is definitely the event for you if you like those kind of things.
And it's worth adding as well that this is a very short notice announcement, we realise, though. If you are members of our Patreon, you will have already heard about it and possibly already signed up. So another incentive to join our Patreon for £4 a month. Get loads of extra bonus episodes. For everybody else who can't make it, who isn't available, or for whom it is already sold out / full up, we'll definitely be doing a lot more of these kinds of events and we'll be announcing them in due course. So, yeah, watch this space.
On to the show. Hello and welcome to Cursed Objects, a podcast all about cultural history, politics and tat. Sort of like a cursed show and tell where every week we take a look at an object and explore the social world that surrounds it. I'm historian Dr. Kasia T, and as ever, I'm joined by...
Dan Hancocks. I'm a journalist and author. Hi, Kash.
Hello. And this week is a super, super special episode because we are joined by a very special guest. Melaina Lamb is a lecturer at the University of Law in London. Hi, Mel.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's so good to have you here. We've been trying to organise this for such a long time and I'm so thrilled. So, and just to introduce you, in the spirit of us only inviting people who really fit in with the cursed objects kind of theme, over the years, I think it's fair to say that Mel, you've really changed how I understand the concept of law and order. Like... God, you've been so patient with me. And I just really, really appreciate it. And I don't know, one of the things with this podcast is we kind of started it because we wanted, like, we were doing all this reading and we realised that we had lots of friends who didn't have time to do, like, the quote-unquote reading or engage with the ideas that, like, Dan and I, because of our jobs, because of, like, you know, the way that we engage with philosophy and history or whatever, they didn't have the time to do that. And I'm so grateful because over the years... I've not had the time to read anything about law and order or really understand it. And you have really just like guided me through it in such a generous way, right? You've got such a generosity of spirit, which is just, it's very cursed objects. And I'm just thrilled to have you here.
Thank you.
I mean, I echo all of that. And I would add, I think Mel was shouted out in possibly our first ever episode, certainly our first season.
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
The Agamben toy.
Yeah, because we were talking about a very relevant subject. Kasia was shouting out all that she'd learned from you about the role that, riot cop dolls and toys play in modern society. Anyway, I'll
let you carry on. How long ago was that now?
Oh, God, it was like 3 years ago.
Yeah. It was very early. It was before we'd... It was when we recorded all of our first series in one go, I think, before we ever announced it. But yeah, I remember it very fondly.
So one of the things that we've obviously spoken about a lot is the police, and it's something that you've written about in your previously co-authored book, Policing the Pandemic, How Public Health Becomes Public Order, and also in your brand new solo authored book, A Philosophical History of Police Power, out with Bloomsbury. So I just want to give a really short quote from your book, if that's okay. It's all going to be within fair use, so I'm not going
to... Imagine if she sued you over this, Catherine. Just, my head would be doing cartwheels. I'd be so confused by what that would mean.
I'm calling my lawyer.
Yeah, you don't study Law and Order for this one without knowing when you can sue your podcast host and mate.
So I just thought this was a really illustrative quote about what your most recent book is about. So in your words, this book is not a history of the police, although you do reflect on some practices, or an etymology in the sense that you don't really focus on the kind of emergence of the police's origins, but a reappraisal of how philosophers have thought about the police, something that you see as vital because, and I quote, a reappraisal of how Western political philosophy has thought or not thought police seems to me necessary given how crucial and unique police power is and, paradoxically, how marginal its place has been in the Western canon of political philosophy. Mm. So, I mean, I just kind of... Oh God, I just love it because it's such an intervention, right? And I think also this is a book which you are speaking to other philosophers, mm-hmm. but at the same time, the themes and the topics that you're talking about, like this is the joy of theory, right? That they change how you view the world. And like, I've been like going through your book being like, what is an oikonomos? But also being like, oh my God, but this is so fascinating because there are so many relevant examples. So yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
What object have you brought us? So I'm going to stop babbling now.
I almost forgot about the object. Okay, so the object that I brought with me today is a police Velcro patch, I guess, like that they're mostly seen as. So it's a small patch that police officers, you might see police officers in the UK wearing. And it's like a greyed out Union Jack flag. Mm. And everything is greyed out except for a thin blue line running through the middle of the cross. Mm. So I noticed in an episode with Hugh Lemmy, you were talking about this, which is nice. So you were talking about, obviously, the pink Union Jack, but at some point you start talking about the thin blue line badge as well, which I thought was really interesting. But what's it called? Vexillology.
The study of flags.
Yeah, that was a new one on me as well. When Hugh said it, I was like, what?
Yeah, Hugh just casually dropped that in.
I know. I'm not a vexillologist. But I also think flags are very interesting and the symbolism behind them is very interesting, and this one in particular in recent years has come under the spotlight for a number of different reasons. Do you want me to
what does it represent? So you've kind of given some of the context that you might see police officers wearing it, but I guess what does it represent, like what's the significance of the blue line?
So I guess it depends who you ask. So there is some debate about what it is supposed to represent. And officers in England say that it's about commemorating police officers that have died in the course of duty. And actually, the place that sells it in England is a charity that like raises money for the families of police officers that have died. But obviously, the idea of the thin blue line is very, very old.
Yes.
It goes back much further than perhaps these flags do. And it's the idea that police are the thin blue line separating like order from chaos or civilization from barbarism and these kinds of things. So it's this really kind of ubiquitous idea that you find in all sorts of places, you know, ranging from police officers themselves who talk about it to like fictional representations of the police where, the police are kind of the only thing separating society from like falling into this abyss of chaos.
Mm. It was a really, really bad sitcom in the 90s
oh
as
my
well.
God, yes.
Do you remember this?
Yes.
I thought you were both too young, but there we go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is itself a fascinating part of kind of the idea of the police and how they're understood is the police procedural as a way of normalising their role and making it feel more cosy and gentle, essentially.
But also,
I mean, it's not
like
a police procedural, it's a police sitcom, but even more so, you know.
Yeah, but like also I feel like what you're kind of framing here is the fact that this is a deeply philosophical framing, right? Yeah. So someone might say, like, oh, why do we need a philosophical history of police power? Like, you know, why don't we just go through reports and think about the institution? And obviously, in this framing of the Thin Blue Line, that is a philosophical framing.
Yeah.
That is like...
By the police.
By the police, that is utilised and weaponised in so many different ways, right? In a, it creates a really powerful philosophical narrative, actually, underpinning them, right?
100%. Yeah, definitely. And in my work, one of the things that I try and do is trace this idea back through different philosophers. So I would say that in this regard, Thomas Hobbes, writing in the context of the English Civil War is really, really important. And his book, Leviathan, is a book about the state and how he thinks... he does a kind of a thought experiment, if you like, and he's like, what would life be like without, if we didn't have a state? But obviously he's writing in the context of the Civil War, so he's thinking about it in terms of like, what if the state kind of collapses as well, right?
Yeah.
In the case of a civil war. But he's like, what was life before without the state? What was it like? And he says it's a state of nature, right? Mm-hmm. So everyone is violent, essentially, or the threat of violence is ever present and pervasive. It's like every man for himself. He calls it a war of all against all. Life is nasty, short, nasty, brutish. What is it?
No, nasty, brutish and short.
That's the one. That's the order I was looking for. And essentially, like, that nothing good can happen while we're in this state of nature, right? Nothing. There can be no art. There can be no thinking. There can be no education. There can be nothing good. Except for every individual just like defending themselves violently. And it's when we give up our individual right to use violence and we transfer that right to the state, to the Leviathan, who then defends us collectively, that's when the good things can happen, right?
Wow.
That's when life can flourish, if you like.
I can see no problems with this.
None at all.
This sounds foolproof.
It's interesting as well because a lot of, you know, that it's... Nature in that sense is not a pre-lapsarian sort of idyll. It's not the Garden of Eden.
No.
It's like the, no, nature, the human nature is wild and violent rather than like in quote unquote civilizing ourselves. We have, you know, eaten the forbidden apple and ruined everything. But no, on the contrary, like it is through state building, civilization building.
Yes, yeah.
And the maintenance of order.
And so a lot
of... creation of order, I suppose.
So Hobbes is commonly seen as like kind of standing at the birth of the modern state and the way of thinking about the state that departs from older conceptions of order as being natural. So with kind of the ancient Greeks, for example, you had this idea that humans were naturally orderly. Now, like, we could talk about that for days. Like, there's nuances to that, and it's not like straightforwardly meaning that that, you know, humans just like live together harmoniously and it's fine. But there was this idea that the order was natural, and then this gets taken up by Christian theologians who say it's divine, right? That like life is orderly because God has made it so through divine providence. And then Hobbes comes along and is like, actually, no, like life isn't naturally orderly. Humans aren't naturally orderly. There is something that makes order, and that is the state.
Oh, interesting. And it is, as you say, the English Civil War is a moment in which it's felt to be extremely possible that everything that is known is going to collapse, right? Is a period of huge social unrest, not just incredible levels of violence and in the sort of battles across the country. You know, we killed our king. We had a revolution. People forget that. The idea that everything that hitherto was existing would go on forever, which is often part of the way that British history is told.
Yes, yeah.
Was actually definitely not necessary. Didn't feel like it was the case.
Sure.
At that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like that's an interesting grounding for him.
There's a common understanding of the state of nature as being the thing that pre-exists the state, right? So Hobbes is like, as I said, people talk about him doing a thought experiment and like, what is life like without or before the state, crucially. But actually, when you think about it in the context of him writing about the Civil War, what he's actually saying is the state of nature is just around the corner. And like, we have to do everything we can to stop it from enveloping us, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's an important distinction, that it isn't actually something that precedes the state, but it's actually something that he's projecting from within a state, and he's afraid of it collapsing.
Okay, gotcha.
If you see what I mean.
Yeah, it's a different reading of it.
Yeah.
Can I say some more about the... Can we talk about the flag a bit more?
Yes.
Because one thing that never occurred to me until 5 minutes ago when we were just describing the thin blue line patch and where the notion of the thin blue line between order and chaos comes from, never occurred to me before that it's a thin line.
Yes.
Like that is that is something they've declared for themselves, that we... And that fits in a lot of other ideas that I'm familiar with in terms of police self-image.
Yes.
And it's worth saying, of course, the police have a self-image, that you could do a really sophisticated, and people have done a really sophisticated sociology of the police and their identity. Like, there's an incredible sense of solidarity there.
That, oh, yeah.
That, like, you know, people who are opposed to police power really, would do well to understand that level of solidarity, and that's represented in the thin blue line better than anything, really.
Yeah, I think that's a really crucial thing to remember, that it is a thin, is a thin line, right? And it's this idea, I was talking to Kasia about this earlier, but actually the idea of this thin line dates back to the Crimean War.
Wow.
And it was originally used in reference to a small regiment of British troops fighting Russian troops, and they were massively outnumbered.
That's such a British military thing, isn't it? to valorize, defeat and being an underdog while simultaneously literally colonizing half the
world. Yeah. So they were the plucky underdogs all dressed in red. And this is where an idea of the thin red line comes from, is somehow they stave off the Russian advance, right? Temporarily, but still they do. And this is where the kind of mythology of this thin line comes from.
Yeah.
And then at some point it gets transposed into other
forms.
Yeah.
Because I noticed as well on that website, so you sent over a website of absolutely fucking insane merch. I cannot tell you how much time I spent on this website.
US police merch.
It's US police merch, kind of around the idea. I think the actual website is called Thin Blue Line USA.
Yeah.
And I whiled away many, many kind of, I don't want to call them unhappy hours, but they were certainly morally complex hours on this website. And I didn't realise that there was, in addition to, because they sell merch, which is thin blue line merch, much of it, but they also sell thin red line merch in relation to kind of soldiers. And they also sell thin green line. And I looked that up, and that was specifically to do with US veterans and I think serving army personnel. So
what are they, the thin green line between war and peace? Being invaded and not being invaded.
Well, I think the green is because of their uniforms. But the whole thing is, so just to kind of speak a little bit about this website, if you don't mind, there was one object which kind of really stood out to me. And it's a bracelet with a thin blue, like a black kind of bracelet with a thin blue line going through the middle. And on it, in white text, it says, "Blessed are the peacemakers."
Oh my God, you're kidding me.
There's so much mad shit on this, but on this
I'm not religious, but I'm offended on behalf of Christians.
But also, doesn't that, it just, it really feels like something that, a particularly mean character in a Cormac McCarthy novel would wear as, a kind of ironic,
Before killing loads of people.
You know, this kind of, co-option of this, this kind of, Christian phraseology in order to, basically, do some seriously bad law enforcement.
Yeah. 100%.
Oh my God, some of the stuff. You can also get just various different bands and badges, some which have thin blue line on one side, and then on the other side say girlfriend.
No girlfriend. Way.
Yeah, police girlfriend.
Yeah, police girlfriend, son, daughter, wife. I don't know. It's just around the kind of £4 mark. I don't know. I don't know why that seems relevant to me, but I was just I don't know who is buying this stuff. It's just,
I think quite a lot of people are.
Yeah.
If there's that much of a range of material available,
So this, I was doing a deep dive into this stuff in preparation.
Thank you.
But it's fascinating. So the guy that set up this website, this website is kind of cited as being the first time that the American flag, which is grayed out with a thin blue line running through it, so they took that from the UK, that imagery.
Oh, right. Yeah. It started here.
And it started here, and then it was taken over to the USA by this guy who started this website in 2014, which is after the killing of Michael Brown and when like Black Lives Matter really kicks off for the first time.
Yeah.
And this guy is like watching everything going on, the guy that creates this website, and is like, oh, hang on a second, I think we need to do something here, and creates this website with all this merch, with the flag and the thin blue line. But before, I mean, this is from my research, from before, this didn't really happen before 2014.
That's so interesting. And it then obviously we can talk about the parallel histories here in the UK and the US,
but
you know, there is a Blue Lives Matter movement in the US, which was in response to BLM.
Exactly.
And which directly speaks to the ostensible rationale for this whole thing existing, right? Which is like, police who have died in the line of duty, all we are doing is expressing our solidarity and commemorating those people. Now, in the US, it took a different turn, right?
Yeah.
Mm. So the...
Yeah, so in the US, it became a flag that started being waved at, most famously Charlottesville.
Okay.
You know, the Charlottesville, what do you want to call it? Not protest, but white supremacist march that they did.
In which two anti-fascist demonstrators were killed, I think, was it one?
Yeah. So it made an appearance at that thing, but it also was used on January 6th when the Capitol building was stormed
By the Proud Boys, who are essentially fascist organisation.
Exactly. And so it's at that point, because it was used by the people that were storming the Capitol building, I think it's at that point that a lot of police officers actually started saying, like we aren't those people, and starting to distance themselves from like the far right and fascists that were seen to be using it at these like public events and in this public way.
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting that you get this kind of distancing from the far right by certain police officers that are like, no, we just wear it as a commemorative thing. But also, UK police are very keen to like distance themselves from the Americans as well when they want to use it and when they're saying we should be allowed to wear it. Because it was banned by one of the police commissioners at from police officers from wearing it at protests.
Recently, really recently, right?
Yeah.
Last year, I think.
Yeah. And then this kind of created a bit of a firestorm of like police officers saying, we are not the US, like we don't have those problems here. That's not what this badge is about. And really trying to distance themselves from its use in the US.
Yeah.
Which I think is also interesting.
Very interesting.
Well, and it's become sort of a political football particularly if you're listening to us from outside the UK, you wouldn't necessarily know this, but the right-wing press and Conservative Party at various points have complained about the fact that the Met Police Commissioner, i.e. the boss of the Met Police, banned it last year. And they've, you know, in a culture war-y sort of fashion, so the current Conservative candidate for Mayor of London...
Sorry.
Wow. Didn't even need to get any further than that. And
what's her name? Like Susan?
Susan Hall. No, she's...
And I'm just calling her Susan, like she's just Susan.
Like Cher or something.
Like Cher, but not as good. Not as good. Like Cher, but really, really,
so
really
So not Cher. Like Cher, actually. Yeah. Sorry,
more
Cher.
More like kind of like your mum's, pal from like, I don't know.
Yeah, who got like radicalised on like... Yeah, online. Right, yeah. No, she's a complete...
Poor Sue.
She's full of shit, honestly. She's one of these people that she came up in my crowds, but research for my crowds book, because she keeps trying to get Notting Hill Carnival moved to Hyde Park.
What?
Even though that's never going to happen, just to piss off the black community, basically. Yeah. But she asked a question at Mayor's Question Time last autumn about the Beat Police badge and like basically just grandstanding for right-wingers, so she can point to what she's done and say, look, I'm defending our boys in blue against these heinous accusations or whatever. What Mark Rowley, the commissioner of the Met Police, came up with in the various interviews that followed this controversy last year was that there are only three acceptable bits of, cloth, things you can append to your uniform if you're a police officer that, have some sort of cultural or political weight. And they are, do you want to guess, actually?
Oh.
What are the three things you're allowed to wear on your uniform?
A poppy?
Correct. Well done. That's number one.
I'm doing a salute in the background. You can't see this.
You're probably not going to get the other two, so I'll just tell you, but that's a great guess. Well done, Mel. A Help for Heroes wristband is okay. And a police memorial badge, which is not the same. I don't quite know what that is, but maybe okay. I guess it's more explicitly like we are commemorating fallen, you know, comrades or what have you, with none of the fash connotations, which are ultimately the reason that this was banned. Like Mark Rowley actually said that. He said, you know, because of its unsavoury associations with the far right in the US, we're just going to say, look, no more badges, and that goes for, you know, any other sorts of... I mean, it's inherently political. It's got a Union Jack on it, is the other thing worth mentioning here.
Yes.
Like, you know, we are representatives of the nation state here.
When I was doing this weird deep dive into, like, forums that were talking about this, and the people that were, like, defending either actual police officers that were like, no, we should be allowed to wear it, or just people defending the police that want them to wear it, so many people were saying... This isn't political. It's an apolitical
badge. So
it's like wearing a poppy. It's not political, right? And my mind was just like exploding because
Kasia laughs in war studies there. Yeah, 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 yeah. The study of history could never be political. It's just history.
Yeah. But honestly, what is going through their minds when they're saying this stuff is apolitical? It's a Union Jack.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's worth saying as well, for again, I think particularly for our overseas listeners, hi guys, hola, that there was a vexillology related controversy only a month ago that was not about the police, but was about subverting not the flag of the United Kingdom, but the flag of England, which was when Nike produced these England shirt for the England football team, and instead of the usual St George's flag, which is a red cross and a white background, they made it sort of blue and purpley and red and stuff. And the right-wing press lost their shit for an entire week. It was the only thing anyone
went
talked about.
Went on for so long, didn't it?
But some people made the point at the time, and I'm glad they did. You know, wait, so does that mean that the thin blue line Union Jack is also a grave offence to our spirit of patriotism? Because that, you know, I mean, it's a great counterpoint. Or indeed the pink jack, for that matter, as well. Like, people fuck with flags. It's fine. Like, that's not... It just shows what a confected sort of drama it was. Because clearly it is political. Like, if you're upset that the England flag looks a bit different, that is for political identitarian reasons,
right?
Yes, It's ID politics, basically.
Not that they would call it that.
No, exactly, the police and their ID politics as well.
Can I ask you about something slightly related? So when I was on this website that you've shared with us, I feel in two minds about putting it into the show notes because I kind of want listeners to go on it, but I also kind of
don't. I don't think people are going to buy anything.
But yes, you can find it at Thin Blue Line USA if you want to Google that. They had like this range of T-shirts that I just thought were like... I went into like their kids' stuff to see what they were selling for kids. And they just had loads of T-shirts that were that were kind of like Thin Blue Line, but like... B2B Shamrock, kind of like B2B, like kind of like Irish heritage. But like that seemed to be the only one that they were doing it with. So like an outline of a shamrock with like a thin blue line, American flag in the middle.
Oh my God, that's incredible.
Yeah. And then I Googled this because I was interested and I found a description of another website that was selling them. And the description is this. St. Patrick Shamrock, police blue line distress flag T-shirt. Just the shirt. For wearing, that's got a little apostrophe at the end of wearing. Oh, the green. Perfect for that Irish law enforcement officer.
Oh my God.
Or just one who loves St. Patrick's Day.
Wow.
So, I mean, the reason for that is just the sheer number of Irish migrants who are dirt poor who ended up signing up to work in the police in the East Coast of the US, right?
Yes.
Like a little substantial. But I didn't realise there were... such a substantial minority within the US police that there weren't any others that could warrant their own T-shirts.
Yeah, I guess it just shocked me because, yeah, it's like there doesn't seem to be like Italian or Polish B2B the police kind of merch. It seemed really, really quite specific on Irish.
And you want to design a Polish one, is that
what
you're
saying? Yeah, that's exactly it. So I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that specifically, because it was just something that kind of cropped up that I hadn't really thought about before.
Yeah, so like Dan was saying, there was... during the kind of waves of Irish emigration to the US, the police became a really popular occupation among Irish immigrants. Mm-hmm. And it's something that to this day is very much like celebrated and remembered. So on St. Patrick's Day, there's a big St. Patrick's Day parade that happens in New York. And the NYPD are like a, you know, they march through the streets of New York. Yeah.
It's just a cultural crossover that I just hadn't really thought about before. And I guess, yeah, it's got this kind of longstanding history in terms of like migration, right? And also why I guess poor Irish migrants to the US would have wanted to join the police is also part of this story, right? Mm. So like it's kind of about like their material deprivation. But yes. I think it's also about the ideas of like whiteness, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
like how, who is allowed to defend the state? Am I right in saying that?
Absolutely. So there's a book called The Abolition of White Democracy by this guy called Joel Olson, who talks about, and I think he's actually talking about a historian that talks about this as well. It's not just him. But he's talking about how essentially the Irish, it wasn't taken for granted that they were white when they entered the US, right, as immigrants. They had to kind of gain white citizenship, if you like. And the way, one of the ways that they were doing this was by joining the police force, right? So they were kind of proving their whiteness or becoming white via their entry into the police force, which was seen as like the ultimate proof and way of becoming white through... Yeah, not only like defending, I guess, you know, the city and the state, but also through like brutalizing African Americans as well.
So you acquire a kind of like social legitimacy, or like that community acquires a sort of social legitimacy through its participation in this particular arm of the state.
Exactly.
I think it's a fascinating idea. I think specifically hearing you talk has reminded me of quite a lot of theories around police power and specifically around police power in the former colonies. So there is this idea that like police power was like finessed, I guess, in the colonial space. And then it was kind of like brought back to the UK, but that there's a separation that colonial policing is different from UK policing, for example. And I just think that there is a kind of interesting symbolism here with like Irish police officers in a former British colonial space going over to the US, also a former...
Having been brutalised by British occupation themselves.
Exactly. And then going over to a US context and then further brutalising a minority within that space.
Absolutely.
Can we talk about the colonial boomerang? That's a perfect introduction. I mean, you basically described it already, but this is something I really enjoyed in reading about in your book, and it's because it was an idea that I think I was only very dimly aware of myself until I started researching protest policing in Britain in the second half of the 20th century for my new book, which we're not talking about today. But but like the way that crowds were policed was so frequently tested out on oppressed colonised populations outside of Britain and then very directly brought back to the metropole. That is the colonial boomerang in question, right? Is that embedded in the idea and the history of the development of policing in Britain anyway?
Yeah, so I think what I try and do in the book is to maybe trouble that narrative a little bit. I don't think that it's completely wrong or irrelevant or anything like that, but I think there's, in contemporary critical literature on the police, there tends to be this quite uncritical reliance on the notion of the colonial boomerang to explain police violence in the contemporary moment.
Right.
And I don't think that it can explain it, really. Mm-hmm. I think it can get us so far. And obviously, as you're saying, you know, there's this history of protest policing, specifically with regards to Northern Ireland and the Hong Kong police manual, which I'm sure you've been reading about, which is all about like public order policing and like how to basically suppress protest and like public
control
order.
Control the crowd.
Exactly. And I think that's all super interesting, but I think when we're talking about people that are being brutalized by the police in the contemporary moment, I don't necessarily think that we can just rely on an origin story to explain it, right? Like how does the origin story of colonial policing allow us to understand the killing of Chris Cabot or Mark Duggan? I don't necessarily think it can. And I think we need to do more work in terms of anti-blackness, white supremacy, what I call the anarchic nature of police power. Mm-hmm. And I think that can get us to a slightly different place that just relying on this colonial origin story can get us to.
I'm so excited that you brought this up because I really wanted you to explain what you mean by the anarchic power of the police, because I know that quite a lot of anarchist pals that are going to be listening to this are going to be like, oh no, what? Like, sounds a bit like anarchist. But yeah, this idea of the anarchic grounding, because you make this quote, you write this in your book, arguing that police are the anarchic groundless ground of sovereignty itself. So you're arguing that the police are the anarchic groundless ground of sovereignty itself.
Yeah.
And by that I interpreted it as you are saying here that police power comes not from the law, but as a separate, albeit related, kind of autonomous form of power.
Yeah.
Sorry if that was just a lot of words, but like, I'm interested in how you frame the police's relationship to power and to law, because I think you make the kind of, some people might think controversial claim that a lot of people say, right, the law, the police are just following the law. And actually, one of the things that you kind of suggest is actually the police are almost like a law unto themselves, right? They're a power unto themselves.
100%. Yeah. I think there's a really common understanding of the police as being a secondary or derivative power, right? First, you have the power of the law that the police then go and enforce or uphold.
Yeah. We're just following the law.
Alternatively, the pre-modern conception of police is commonly thought of as the idea of a kind of sovereign will, so that the king or the monarch would impose their will via this idea of the police, right? Mm. So it's, again, police appears as this secondary or derivative power, either as imposing a monarch's will or in modern times as upholding or enforcing a law that already exists.
Yeah.
And I think this is to get the relationship the wrong way round.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think we have to understand how the police aren't really enforcing or upholding a pre-existing law, but are in fact acting anarchically, right?
Yeah.
Which is to say, without an origin or direct command. So they're working, as you say, kind of autonomously. They're producing their own legitimating grounds on which they operate.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is that the police frequently will act, and then if it comes to it, the law will then retroactively justify that activity.
Yeah.
So a good example that I often talk about for this is the power to stop and question was not a power that was granted to the police, but it was just something that they started doing.
What?
Because they could, right? Because they have
Because they got uniforms and weapons.
And the threat of violence, right? And so they just started doing it. And then it was the attempt to try and codify that power because politicians, lawmakers were like, hang on a second, like, this is happening pervasively anyway. So we kind of need to do something to like codify this power. So by codifying the power, they then grant them that power and legitimize it, right? So it's not that the law was like, the police have the power to do this. It's that the police were just doing it anyway. And then the law adjusts itself to legitimize and make lawful the power that they were already
doing. So that was unlawful, right?
So sus laws, for example, that, you know, provoked the... were among the things provoking the uprising in Brixton in 1981, or presumably a really good example of that. Or another sort of, we could probably be here all day naming acts of arbitrary police brutality and violence in various different categories, but one that always strikes me when writing about the policing of protest and protest generally is this idea of punishment by arrest, where people who... there isn't a legitimate charge available to them, but they will arrest some protesters who are, you know, pissing them off or whatever, on entirely spurious grounds. Mm. So take, for example, the 150 people that peacefully sat down in Fortnum and Mason on Regent Street in 2011 to protest against tax avoidance, including tax avoidance by the Crown, which owns Fortnum and Mason. It's like the Queen's grocer.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's the Queen's grocer, which is why all the posh people go there and the tourists. But yeah, 150 people extremely peacefully and quietly sat down in the shop that was open anyway. Didn't have to force the door or anything. 150 people were then arrested on a completely spurious charge of, I think, breach of the peace or something, or trespassing, possibly. Ultimately, all of those people are then dragged through the courts for about 2 years, gradually whittling down the number of people who are charged to about six, you know, sort of totemic people, protesters. Eventually, they are, all the charges are dropped, and I think those people won compensation. This happens routinely, but what they've done in the process is snuff out the entire, that entire protest movement, which was called UK Uncut for younger listeners or whatever. And so it's punishment by arrest and through judicial process.
100%.
And they know they're not getting a conviction because they know these people haven't done anything wrong. Yeah. It happens over and over and over again.
Right? Yeah. Mm.
But yeah, it's, you know, it's a great example of the police working in collusion with the rest of the state.
Yes.
Don't know if they're taking orders from somewhere to overreach. But it works.
Mm. I think that's why, like, an intervention like yours, which is really about interrogating the relationship between, like, between the police and the law, right? But I think some of the interesting questions that you kind of think through, or kind of allowed me to think through, is just not just how we are policed, but why we are policed.
Yeah.
But then also, who is policed, right? How have we got into a kind of system, or like, what is the kind of underpinning which allows everyone to just accept, like, point blank, that, like, the police are a social good, and that, like, they have a tough job. And I don't, you know, I don't deny that the police probably do, like, tough stuff, right? Like, you know, I get that as part of it, but how that becomes kind of the defense for anything.
Yeah.
People become incredibly emotive about defending what the police do, and without actually really interrogating a lot of the stuff that they mishandle and they mismanage and all of that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. But I think you know, when we think about, and I talk about this with my students a lot, when we think about the function of police, right, the first thing that people often reach for when you talk about, you know, what is the purpose of police, what's their function, is crime, right?
Yeah.
That's the first thing that people think of, right? They are there to either prevent or to detect people who already have broken the law. And actually, Robert Rayner, who's a criminologist in, I think he's at LSE, he talks about really how marginal crime is to the job of policing.
Mm.
So, like, it's really not a big part of their job. And he says that less than a third of time spent on duty is devoted to crime, and 6% of patrol time is devoted to crime.
Wow.
So think about that.
So a related idea I wanted to ask you about is the idea, obsession we have in this country. So let's narrow it down to Britain specifically, because I feel like, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but most nations will have very different historic relationships and attitudes to their police. But we love talking about bobbies on the beat in British politics. It is the idea of a visible presence.
Yeah.
Even if they're not doing anything, because only 6% of that time is spent, is spent trying to address crime. A visual representation, I mean, clearly not everybody likes that, but it is something that is talked about and by our politicians when they're contesting elections a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
you mean
so
the
much.
Visible presence?
Yeah, the visible presence specifically. But also the fact that bobbies, you know, the way that they're talked about is...
Robert Peel. Tiny, like, when, like, you know, because we did this in the Wenlock episode.
Yeah.
Like, how crazy that you can have an Olympic mascot that is dressed up as a police officer.
Yeah.
Like, it's
would
like,
anywhere else in the world do that?
I don't know. Yeah.
It's a really good question in itself. But it's a good question in itself that I think speaks to, yeah, what I want to ask Mel about, which is, yeah, what are some of the specific foibles about the way that British people think about the police, and relatedly, can you explain policing by consent? This sort of sense of, like, a cuddly police force that, that was never paramilitary. Like, it's often pointed to as a...
So, when Robert Peel created the Met Police, he faced a lot of opposition, I suppose. So people in England were not really up for it. And there was a lot of kind of bad feeling about it, because in places like France and Germany, the police was associated with the police state, which was like an absolutist state with like lots of police spies and like covert surveillance, right?
Wow.
And so there was a lot of English people being like, this does not, you know, bode well for our strong English doctrine of liberty and, you know, individual freedom, and we don't like this is like some foreign continental notion of police. We don't like it, we don't want it here, kind of thing. So I think my reading of it is that they kind of had to engage in a bit of a PR campaign, right? To try to sell this idea of the institution of the police to the British public. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways they did this was through this idea of the Peelian principles, which Robert Peel didn't actually write, but they are called, they are nevertheless
if anyone creates some principles and names it after me, I'll be very pissed off.
But yeah, nevertheless, they are called the Peelian principles. And one of those is this idea of policing by consent, right? Mm-hmm. So this is one of the big kind of ways that it gets sold to the British public is like, look, you know, actually, if you think about it, everyone is consenting to the police. Mm. Another pillar of the of this Peelian principle, list of Peelian principles is the police are the public and the public are the police.
Right.
So
civilians in uniform, right?
Yes. The police are just like some guy, like, don't worry about it. Like, he could be you or me and he's our mate and like, don't worry about it, it's fine. And I think it really speaks to this idea that, you know, the police are friendly, as you say, kind of cuddly, bobbies on the beat, right? They're nothing to be afraid of. They're not these like secretive spies that are gonna, you know, try and curtail your freedom, but rather are the condition for our freedom collectively. And
they are the thin blue line that maintains your sense of freedom and
But I think that the idea in particular, those two principles in particular are so funny because A, the idea of policing by consent, you know, the idea that we consent to be policed, essentially, that we've all collectively decided that it's a good idea that the police exist and therefore we consent. It's interesting on the government website when you look up that idea, at the bottom it's got like a little asterisk and it's like, by the way, you can't as an individual withdraw your consent.
That's so funny. Legal disclaimer. That's amazing. FYI. That's so interesting.
So it's like, so how is it consent if you're not allowed to withdraw your consent is my question.
Also,
right?
How's it consent if you're like the way that you explain the story of how this happened in the 1820s, the Royal Appeal is you were told that you were going to consent.
Yeah,
that's not what consent is. No. Hey everyone, just so you know, you consent to this.
Exactly, but it's a very fucked up notion of consent, right? The idea that you consent to something, ultimately, if you don't want to do what the police are telling you, they can force you anyway with violence, right? I don't see how consent has anything to do with any of
backed
that.
Backed up with the threat of violence.
Yeah, precisely. And then obviously this idea that the police are the public and the public are the police. I mean, what I try and do in the book is kind of think about police power. The fact that police have the power to kill, right, and it not be considered a crime, I think this is not an incidental characteristic of their power, right? It's actually the very foundation on which their power rests, in a way. Mm. And I think, obviously the public, you know, if you or I kill someone, it will be considered a crime. Yeah. Like, there's the idea that the police are just the public and the public are the police, again, you know, none of that bears any critical scrutiny whatsoever.
Including empirical scrutiny. Now, I'm afraid I can't cite the particular bit of paper or research that I'm thinking of here, but it was a programme I heard on Radio 4 about 15 years ago about...
Solid source, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely will pass all of your, like, Harvard referencing scrutiny. But yeah, it was on the radio, so it must have been true. But there was a programme about the history of the TSG, the Territorial Support Group, which is the riot police basically in London, and they it wasn't a history of it, but they were interrogating and trying to find out after the killing of Ian Tomlinson by a TSG officer. Ian Tomlinson was a homeless man walking through central London, was attacked from behind.
Was he homeless?
He was on his way back to his shelter. He was on his way back to his shelter, and he was a big issue seller.
Right.
And he wasn't at he wasn't taking part in this protest. He was walking through central London, but that was enough for this one TSG officer to decide that he would attack him from behind. The guy had a heart attack and died. That guy was cleared of any wrongdoing, but he was found to have. There were a number of incidents in this one riot cop's backstory that showed he was definitely a danger to the public.
Yes.
That had not been considered, which is a very common thing. Anyway,
it's law and order working, right?
From that perspective. So this program and this research were interrogating the idea that, is there any self-selection in terms of who joins the riot police? in terms of people being psychopathic and indulging in wanton violence. And yes, there is, basically.
Yes. Yeah.
So in that very literal, empirical sense, the police are not the public. They are not representative of the public or a reasonable sample thereof. Like,
yes, yeah.
They are not like your nan.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They're not going to hand you a word as original. Yeah. Be on your way. It's just not what's going to happen.
Because if your nan attacked and killed somebody in the street, she would undergo like some degree of due process. Yeah. Probably be charged with murder. Yeah.
I just want to, because we're running out of time, but like I'm really annoyed because there's so much to discuss. Yeah. And a lot of listeners to the show know that Dan and I are very invested in Walter Benjamin. And I know that you are an absolute Walter Benjaminite. Like, we've had many Walter Benjamin themed discussions over the years. And you write about Walter Benjamin in your book. And I just wondered if you could give some of the listeners, I mean, I don't want to presume that some of the listeners to this show love Walter Benjamin as much as we do, but I just wondered if you could maybe outline a little bit around what Walter Benjamin says about the police.
Yeah, so he's got this really great text called The Critique of Violence, which is, it's dense and it's quite hard to get through in some ways.
That
but
doesn't sound like Walter Benjamin.
It's totally worth it. It's absolutely brilliant. So Walter Benjamin talks about security situations where the police are sort of acting and setting their own aims that they are then achieving, right? So it becomes, their power becomes dislocated from the law at the same time as being obviously connected to it.
Which is why legislation like the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, which went through last year, and the new Public Order Bill, there was like two bits of legislation from the Tories, from Priti Patel, and then she didn't manage to get all of the outrageous stuff into the first bill, so they did another one.
Yes.
But a lot of that is exactly as you describe it, is affords, because it's imprecise.
Yeah.
Like causing a nuisance. It's basically just a gift to overreach. It's a gift to police commanders on public order, on like demos and stuff, to do what the fuck they want.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, it gives them the discretion.
But also it's interesting because this is making me reframe how I understand that, because speaking now is making me think, fuck, this is how it was always meant to be. This was how it was always meant to be. The police always act and then the law follows. Mm. So, of course, the police have already been doing this and now the law is just following, as it always does, right? Mm. As it has in so many examples previously. And I think that helps me to understand what the fuck is going on, because you see something like that and you think, oh, it's a move by a draconian, awful government, right? Which it is. Mm. But it's also actually just following the due process of what the police do and are.
Although, can I now problematise that by putting a counterpoint that you've just made me think of? Thank you, Cash. Which is that very recently, with marches in solidarity with Palestine, you've had the unlikely and unusual and slightly bewildering situation for those of us on the left that are always interested in critiquing how, you know, the police protests. You've had the police commander, Mark Rowley, in London, effectively pushing back against the Conservative government that want him to ban these marches.
Yeah.
So, like, the police, not for the first time, are themselves a political football ball. Not denying they obviously have loads of political agency themselves in all sorts of ways. Mm. But you've had this really odd situation where Mark Rowley and other senior Met officers, who, you know, just to be clear, I am extremely suspicious of at all times, but they have been the ones saying, look, we've policed six of these demos already. You know, maybe this is like, say, November, December last year. Policed six or seven of these demos already. These are not hate marches. These are very, very peaceful marches, and we would be the first to say if they weren't. Mm-hmm. But you had Suella Braverman and Rishi Sunak, like, really kind of gunning for the cops and saying they must ban these hate marches. They don't even have the power to do that.
But I wonder if, in a way, that's like not a separate issue. It's obviously a connected issue. But I guess one of the things that I was thinking about in relation to those marches, and like, I don't think it came in, but maybe I'm wrong about this. But the idea that if you went on those marches and, for example, your immigration status was like unsettled or whatever, that then if you were then arrested by the police on whatever grounds that they might say, then your treatment would be particularly pernicious. And sure, I think it's not just about the concept of the protest, which I think is obviously part of it, but there is a secondary issue here, which is about like how the people who are then policed, like how they then fare through the systems, I guess. Am I right in saying that or wrong?
I was just going to say something slightly different, but I think that's super interesting what you were talking about, the kind of, no, we need to, like, we'll let these protests kind of go ahead, but then the policing of them in terms of, like, trawling social media, and then, like, after the marches, arresting people for holding what are very, like, uncontroversial placards, I would say, right? And trawling social media and looking for people that are supposedly supporters of Hamas. Like, this is something that the police are doing, even though, like, Mark Rowley has said, like, these protests should be allowed to go ahead, like, we can't ban them. There's still been this really insidious policing of them, right? Which is...
Completely, and that... I suppose one thing I wanted was to just sort of problematize the idea that, like, because we were correctly saying, you know, the police lead and the law follows, but the police are part of a complex, you know,
the state
is a complex kind of fortress containing multiple actors who are always pushing each other in slightly different directions and all have different types and quantities of power and in which, you know, the media are play a crucial role in mediating how we understand all of these different power blocks, obviously. But yes, the pernicious kind of new ways of policing civilians are evolving all the time. Yeah. You know, we have facial recognition trials going on all over the country at the moment, fairly routinely.
So, it's interesting because Walter Benjamin talks about that he's like, at least in authoritarian states, like the police are telling you who they are and what they're doing.
Okay,
and he's like, in liberal democracies, it's actually much more pernicious and insidious, like the way that the police operate, right? Because they sort of... do things a lot, there's a lot more kind of going through the back door, I suppose, in liberal democracies, right? Sure. Where it's much more about, no, you do have individual freedom, the police are simply there to protect that freedom, right? Yeah. And then that allows the police to act in ways that maybe are not so blatant, but also, you know, are very oppressive and
like the spy cops. I hesitate to even call it a scandal because like scandal's not a big enough word. Scandal is an event that happens, you know.
It's like one, some MP one weekend. Some woman.
Exactly. This isn't a scandal, this is an ongoing campaign of like targeted victimization, persecution, and indeed rape of like the activists, overwhelmingly from the left.
Yeah.
Like they were never there was one of the commanders in the current ongoing spy cops trial or inquiry rather that's going on at the moment and it's going to go on for another 10 years I think. They've just got so much evidence to get through.
Yeah.
But one of the police commanders from the 80s or 90s said that there was a high level decision not to bother infiltrating the far right. At a point where like the far right were like actually a genuinely dangerous street presence every fucking day.
Yes.
And like beating up people of colour on a regular basis. They're like, no, bit more concerned about these like people that want to save gerbils from being dissected. Like that was which was a big deal in the 90s. But yeah, anyway.
Protect the gerbil.
Yeah. Well no, like just I mean animal vivisection generally.
But interestingly, thin blue line patch has been seen most recently at, you know, the pub in Honor Oak holding the drag story time thing. And there's been, I think they're called Turning Point UK, this organisation that have been protesting the fact that this pub is hosting a drag story time thing for children. So this, like, and they're like a fascist organisation.
Basically
right?
inspired by the American equivalent,
showing up at Honor Oak pub. Like most Saturdays, I think, like going there and protesting. I think the pub has even stopped doing it now because it's just like too much. But the police who have been policing those events, apparently the thin blue line patch has been seen at those events, right? Which I think is quite illustrative and interesting.
Having been banned already.
Yeah.
If you're on a demo, like do keep an eye out for this, for this badge on a cop because... they're not allowed. They're just technically not supposed to be wearing them.
Yeah.
So it's even more. I feel like it's even more of a profound act of defiance that itself probably signals that person is on the right, at least.
Mm. Yeah, and it's. I don't think it's a coincidence that they're showing up at that kind of event. Right? It's that kind of presentation and symbolism of their links with the far right and them standing with the far right, they're taking pictures with Lawrence Fox when he goes
it's an expression of solidarity essentially
100%
with the far right.
Fucking hell,
is that a good place to end on?
Mel, I feel like we could talk to you for hours more, and I had so many more questions.
Same.
Your book...
You'll simply have to buy the book.
Yeah, all of you. Yeah. Your book, Philosophical History of Police Power, which has a fabulous cover and a fabulous title, is out with Bloomsbury. And I'm just so grateful that you came on to explain this, because it's like Left 101, right, to feel a kind of hatred for the police. But actually, I think to properly interrogate the kind of philosophy underpinning that is just, yeah, I hope the listeners love it as much as we have.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Amen to that. Thanks, Melina.
Thanks so much. It's been a joy.
Listeners, if you've enjoyed this episode of Cursed Objects, consider supporting us on Patreon. For as little as £4 a month, you can get stickers and you can get our undying thanks. And also, when we do a live show, you'll be the first to know.
Also, you get regular episodes.
Oh, yeah,
as well.
Of course.
I was waiting for Cassia to say that one. Every other episode is a Patreon-only episode.
Yes.
As you've probably encountered already, getting a sort of 10 to 15-minute snippet on Spotify or iTunes and then being crushed with disappointment because you don't get the rest of it. So do sign up if you are able to. But also, don't worry, we'll keep making episodes for free as well.
Thanks so much for listening. Bye.
Thanks, Mel.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks, Mel.